From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports, also columnist for Dow Jones and USA Today. Joining me on the panel this week via Skype are Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal. Also, Emily Tamkin. She is U.S. editor at The New Statesman. Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. It's mostly about, of course, the coronavirus. President Trump says he is cutting off funds to the World Health Organization. He claims they did not do enough to stop the spread of COVID-19. The president also declares he has the authority to reopen the country, not the 50 states. The Constitution, of course, says otherwise. Meantime, world leaders hope that tests, technology, and a coordinated approach will help ease tight restrictions on the movement of people. And turning to the 2020 campaign here in the United States, Democrats are lining up behind Joe Biden, the former vice president, getting very big endorsements from his former rival, Bernie Sanders, also his old boss, former President Barack Obama. Well, let's start with President Trump and the World Health Organization. The president says he is cutting off American funding to the WHO. He claims they did not do enough to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The president says he was not warned in time, and yet, Tom, we'll start with you here. The record does show that the president was warned months ago by U.S. intelligence reports about a possible pandemic, and we also know that he downplayed this, if not outright ignored it, for several weeks. Is cutting off funding for the WHO, Tom, just an attempt by the president to shift blame for all this?
Well, that's got to be a large part of the calculation, Paul. There's a political component to everything that happens in the U.S. government. I should say the U.S. government has already contributed about $60 million in dues to the World Health Organization. And I think this is an attempt by the president, one, to express his irritation with the WHO, and also to reinforce his base. I mean, this is an international organization closely allied with the United Nations. It operates out of Geneva. And a lot of the president's political supporters don't have much use for the United Nations, and neither does the president, frankly. So I think it's a positioning. Now, you know, I have no brief for the WHO. It's pretty clear they are have given China a bit of a free ride here. They seem to accept many of the Chinese explanations about how the virus was under control, and that turns out not to be correct, to put it mildly. But I think this is picking a fight, and I suspect in the end, most of the U.S. government's contribution, which is about $450 million a year, I suspect most will be restored. At the moment, it's just a suspension.
Well, why, Emily, does President Trump think he needs to rely on the WHO for information here when, as I mentioned, he's got his own intelligence agencies who warned him months ago about this?
He doesn't think that he needs to rely on the WHO, because if he thought that, then when the WHO declared this an emergency, he wouldn't a month later have still been saying that the coronavirus is under control in the United States. Yes, of course, you can criticize the WHO. You can say that it's enthralled to China, which, by the way, it's able to be because the United States has left this power vacuum under President Trump and his obsession with national sovereignty and disrespect for multilateral international institutions. Okay, you can say, yes, they were wrong about how the virus spreads. Yes, they were too soft on China. Yes, you can say all of that. But that's not the reason that this is so bad in the United States. The United States and South Korea both reported their first cases to the WHO on the same day. South Korea had test and trace, and we had a president who completely denied that this was an issue and likened it dismissively to the flu. So, you know, yes, you're correct to point out that he ignored his own intelligence officials, but he also ignored the WHO, which he's now saying, oh, they didn't give me information. That's not true. And the reason that the United States has been so hard hit by this is not the WHO. It is not a partisan statement to say that the reason that this is as bad as it is in the United States is because of the Trump administration.
Now, meantime, you've got health experts saying that this is exactly the wrong thing to do. Bill Gates, of course, the software mogul turned philanthropist, says, and I'm quoting here, this is as dangerous as it sounds. And also former President Jimmy Carter, who has spent literally decades trying to stamp out disease around the world, has also been very critical about this. This question for either one of you, how exactly does President Trump think that cutting off funding for the WHO, how does he think that will actually help win the fight against this virus?
It's hard to know what's in the president's mind about this. I suspect the president does not think deeply about this. I think he is looking to blame the WHO, just like he's looking to blame some others for what has happened here. You know, Bill Gates is about as apolitical as they come, and I happen to know that former President George W. Bush thinks that while the WHO is not perfect, they do a lot of good things around the world. So the optics of this are probably very good for the president's political base, but otherwise he has really been roundly criticized through much of the world for this, and I don't think there's any way you can argue that by cutting off funds, if he does that to the WHO, that it's going to help with this terrible pandemic.
Well, let's move on here. Here in the United States, there's actually some data that appears to suggest that things might actually be getting a little bit better, particularly in areas that have really been just really badly hit by this virus, New York and Washington states, for example. And I'll give you one example of this. It does appear that in the past week or so, that the number of new cases, they're still growing, but they are not growing exponentially as they did not too long ago. Now, this appears to be fueling calls by some, notably the president, that, of course, the U.S. economy should be opened up sooner rather than later. But, Emily, there are a lot of health experts who are more cautious about this, saying, well, we've got to be very careful about opening things back up and getting back to normal. What is the time frame for this as you see it? And what would a so-called reopening of the economy, what would that look like?
Well, what it's not going to look like is the flip of a switch where one day we're all in our homes and the next day we can go out to bars and restaurants and concerts again. Based on everything that health experts have said, this is going to be very slow and very gradual and very careful, as it should be, because we still don't have sufficient test and trace in place, right? So the reason that those of us who can have been asked to stay home is to slow the spread so that hospitals aren't overwhelmed. If you do not have sufficient test and trace in place, it is still very dangerous to let everybody go back out. And I understand that people have been hit by economic hardship. Millions of people signed up for unemployment benefits. This is going to be, what, the greatest recession since the Great Depression? So I am not unsympathetic to the desire to let the economy open back up. But the reason that Dr. Fauci has been saying we really can't do that until we have sufficient testing in place is because that will bring us sort of back to where we started. The reason that it's plateauing in some places, the reason that it's not as bad as it could have been, is that we took and are still taking these very strong mitigating steps.
Now, just to give our global listeners, you mentioned Dr. Anthony Fauci. He is a doctor and an immunologist who has been one of the country's leading experts on diseases and pandemics for quite some time. Just some background on him. Tom, moving on here, you know, the president also claims that he has the authority to reopen the country, not the 50 states, but of course the Constitution says otherwise. It seems that presidential authority is more limited than the president seems to think.
Yeah, a few days ago in one of his daily press conferences, he said that he, the president, had total authority. He said, my authority is total on the issue of reopening states. He doesn't have a lot of people who support him on that, including the United States Constitution, which says unless otherwise specified, powers given to the executive branch, meaning the president, all other things, unless set out for the president, are reserved for the states. It's called the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. And the fact is, very few people believe the president has that authority. And I think within 24 hours, he backed off at the next briefing. He said, I am going to lay out guidelines for each state, and I will authorize states to consider these guidelines. So it's clearly going to be the states will decide. I suppose the president could order all federal agencies to to reopen immediately and to order their employees back to work. But basically, it's going to be each individual state. Some will open parts of their states earlier. Some will wait a while. For instance, the District of Columbia, the nation's capital, the mayor of the District of Columbia has moved back her timeline to May 15th. So even if the rest of the country opened up on May 1st, which it will not, in the District of Columbia, it's May 15th, and a couple of states have already said June at the earliest. So Emily is quite right. It's not a flip of the switch, and it will be very different in different parts of the country. The president is really, it's important to him to get the country open as soon as he can, but it's not going to be quite as quick or as vast as he would like, for the simple reason that you can't have 80,000 people go to a stadium, sit elbow to elbow, and watch a football game. It's not going to happen. I mean, even if it were allowed to happen, I suspect that most people will not yet feel comfortable enough to do that, even if they were permitted to do so.
You kind of get the sense, Tom and Emily, that as things begin to gradually reopen, I completely agree, it certainly cannot be a flip of a switch, that it will be a gradual process and people will begin to do some of the things that we've always done, restaurants and concerts and stuff. It's sort of a confidence issue. I think individuals have to be confident enough to know that they can go to these things and enjoy themselves without having to worry about the person sitting next to them. So that's a series of individual decisions that we're all going to have to make, despite what the president says. So this could be actually a very long, drawn-out process, I think. Anyway, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on VOA's website at voanews.com. Now let's return to our panel. Tom DeFrank, he's contributing editor to National Journal. Also, Emily Tamkin, she is the U.S. editor at The New Statesman. Both join me today on Skype. And you know, Tom and Emily, it seems like if there's a silver lining to be had in this terrible global crisis, you've got these scientists and researchers and others all around the world who are working very closely together, trading data and information to fight this virus that will certainly and hopefully speed up an eventual vaccine. And also new technologies like artificial intelligence that will help speed up testing and the eventual discovery of that vaccine. Meantime, though, we've been talking about the United States here, but other parts of the world have issues of their own. Of course, Europe very badly hit, particularly Spain and Italy, and not enough has been said about Africa, where you've got these less developed countries, less developed economies that are having all kinds of problems, lack of infrastructure, food supply being a big problem. That has always been an issue on parts of that continent. Emily, tell us about, we've been kind of looking up on Africa. What do you think is going on there?
I mean, first, I think it's important to sort of, I know you know this, but just for our listeners, to stress that it's an entire continent, and obviously not every country there is experiencing this the same way. So for example, in South Africa, they're already talking about, you know, the curve is flattening. What's sort of the next phase of this? In other countries, though, yes, exactly as you say, there is infrastructure problems. There's going to be food shortages. It's not built for a lockdown like the one that we're, or a stay in place. And actually, ProPublica reported that the State Department issued a memo warning Trump against suspending the World Health Organization funding to the WHO for this very reason, right? Because the WHO has, in places like Libya, been extremely important. So I mean, there's no sort of short or good answer for this other than, yes, this language that, oh, the virus is a great equalizer, anyone can get it, any nation can, okay, well, yes, anyone can get it, but not every individual or society or group of people or country is set up to deal with it in the same way.
Tom, any thoughts on this?
One of the great fears of scientists and physicians is that just as one can hope that the crisis is a little bit better, slightly better in the United States, and there's no way to know for certain whether parts of the world that have luckily not had this kind of pandemic yet could yet have that occur. When they say a global pandemic, that is an understatement, that's for sure.
And the other thing to consider here is that when people eventually get the individual confidence to go out and do things, try and resume some semblance of the life that they had before, there are fears that there could be a second, perhaps even a third wave of this virus. So is it possible that these lockdowns and restrictions and so forth that we're seeing now, that we could be revisiting all of this in 6 months, 12 months? Is that possible?
I think it is entirely possible. The experts say there's another flu season coming in the fall, and it's entirely possible, despite significant progress, hopefully by then, that we would have to start this all over again in the fall. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that there will be a vaccine by then. I think we'll have a vaccine sooner rather than later, but that's still months away, not 18 months away, which is the average. But even so, it's entirely possible that a vaccine will not be ready by the fall when we have the next flu season cycle.
Let's move on to the 2020 election here in the United States. There's no question now that Joe Biden, the longtime former senator from the state of Delaware, and of course the 8-year vice president during the presidency of Barack Obama, he of course will be the Democratic nominee. There's no question about that now. In the past couple of days, he has gotten two very big endorsements, perhaps the biggest endorsements he could hope to get, in fact, one from his former rival, Bernie Sanders, the senator from the state of Vermont, and also his former boss, the former president, Barack Obama, who thinks that Biden, of course, will make an excellent president. Tom, the significance of these two men, Sanders and Obama, lining up behind Joe Biden. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it's important because the nomination is no longer in doubt. And Sanders could have stayed in. He has several hundred delegates. He could have stayed in the hunt, but he chose not to do that. And I think that's important because I can remember cutting my teeth on situations like this in 1976, where President Gerald Ford was challenged by former California Governor Ronald Reagan, and it just caused a terrible rift and schism in the Republican Party. And Ford never truly recovered from that. And to his dying day, he thought that Ronald Reagan was largely responsible for Ford's loss to Jimmy Carter in 1976. Well, now we're 6.5 months out from the election, and at least on the surface, there is unity within the party. And of course, now Obama, President Obama, who everyone knew was going to support Biden, who was holding back because he didn't want to look like he was getting in the middle of a primary battle, now he doesn't have to hold back. I would also add, Paul, there are three important endorsements here. With Barack Obama comes Michelle Obama, and I think she is going to be a formidable asset to Joe Biden as well, especially among African-American women. She's very popular among Democrats. She's very popular among African-American women, widely admired in this country. Biden gets a twofer with the Obamas, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama.
Here's a question that I have for either of you. Global listeners might not know this, but every day, President Trump has been holding briefing on the coronavirus, and it's on all of the cable television channels, and he talks and talks and talks about all kinds of things. He's getting lots of attention too, and he's not just talking about coronavirus, he's talking about kind of slipping in campaign messages and this and that. Joe Biden cannot match that. What can he do to kind of ramp up his visibility in the weeks and months ahead to kind of convince voters that he's up to the job?
I mean, he's been doing these live streams, right? But I think that he has said, I know that he has said that he doesn't want to get into a political fight with Donald Trump over the coronavirus pandemic. And on the one hand, I can understand not wanting to politicize, you know, something that's a tragedy for millions of people. On the other hand, sir, you are the Democratic nominee for president. The incumbent is currently, according to many people, not doing what he should be doing in this task. So I think that Joe Biden sort of needs to start addressing that, right? You can't dance around that. So it's not only getting more visibility, although yes, of course, as he is now the nominee, there should be more media attention, live stream rallies, et cetera, within the confines of this very strange situation in which we find ourselves. But it's also recognizing that this is now Biden and the Democratic Party versus Trump. And I think Democrats sometimes have this instinct to not fight. And I think that obviously it's Vice President Biden's choice, but it's one that many will question if he sort of decides not to fight. I mean, it's a political campaign, right? So how are you deciding not to fight with Trump over the major issue of the day?
Tom, let me come back to Bernie Sanders just for a minute. You know, the big question about him, I suppose, is all of these younger Americans, these so-called millennials, he had a lot of support among them, but they did not come out and vote. And the question is, if they are, some of them are unhappy that he has dropped out, the question is, will these young folks migrate to the Biden camp? And even more important than that, would they actually show up in November and vote? To me, that's a very big question.
A big question, a huge challenge for Biden and the Democrats. And when Sanders dropped out a few days ago, he seemed to me to go out of his way to say to younger voters, this is your chance. Sanders has been very tough in his rhetoric about President Trump. He said he's corrupt, he's a pathological liar, but he also went on to say the young people who have not been around for four or five or six presidential elections, this is your chance to make a difference and that you have to come out. And I think that is, I think Sanders will continue to say that, and more to the point, the Democrats have got to spend more money mobilizing and organizing to get younger voters out. And I think it's probably as helpful as Sanders has embraced Biden right now, because he's basically saying, I'm inside the tent with Joe Biden. I think I can influence his policies going forward in a progressive way. But you younger voters, you've got to get inside the tent and you've got to get out to vote.
So yes, Sanders has announced his support for Biden. There are other younger progressive politicians like the quote unquote squad members in Congress. So you have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you have Ilhan Omar, who are saying we will support the nominee, but we want to see him make concessions to quote unquote younger voters, who, by the way, are younger voters here means voters under 50, because those were the voters who preferred Sanders to Biden. So when you have Biden saying, well, my concession to you is lowering the age of eligibility for Medicare to 60, you know, that is not for a young, quote unquote, young voter. Like, that's not a concession. So yes, I agree that, you know, obviously Sanders is saying to younger voters, come join me in the tent. We can have more influence here than we can from outside. But there's a younger generation of politicians that's saying, well, wait a minute, before I come into the tent, you know, I'll tick the box for you in November, fine. But before I come into the tent and bring my people with me, what are you going to do for, not just for me, but for my generation?
There's been some talk, Tom, about the Trump campaign has a lot more money in the bank to spend on things like a digital advertising. Team Biden is well behind in the money here, and that is going to be a big problem. How can they get their messages out when they don't have the money to match the firepower that Trump seems to have?
It's a serious problem. Money talks, obviously. It's a cliche, but it really is true. And Biden has been hurt by this pandemic in the sense that he has not been able to go out and do 20 fundraisers around the country. He's been doing virtual fundraisers. And it's always better if you can shake some big donor's hand and give him a photo access and all those sorts of things. So raising money virtually is not very satisfactory. And I think this is a problem that they're going to have to figure out a way to deal with. They've got to tap back into a failed candidate, Michael Bloomberg, hope he will open his considerable pockets.
Well, I think the future handshakes may give way to elbow bumps when this is all over, but we'll see. Well, that's all the time we have for now. Thanks to our two panelists who joined us via Skype. Tom DeFrank, he's contributing editor to National Journal. Also, Emily Temkin, U.S. editor at the New Statesman. Thanks to you both. I'm Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports, Dow Jones, and USA Today. This program was produced by Kim Lewis. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.